Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, we have a very special conversation with Kenneth Turan, recorded on his last day in the position of Times film critic, a spot he held for nearly 30 years. It was a warm, wide-ranging talk about his years reviewing movies and how the culture of film criticism and Hollywood itself has changed and where it may be headed. He recalled some of his most memorable reviews and interviews, including the response to one review, yes, that one, that left him flabbergasted. And we talk about how his approach to the work of being a film critic has evolved over time. It's been an honor to consider him a colleague in my own time at the paper, and so now here is my interview with Kenneth Turan. Kenny, so many people recently have been talking about watch lists, things to watch at home, what they're watching at home. And I couldn't help but wonder, what have you been watching at home recently? Like, do you have like a bunch of movies that you've always meant to watch and have never quite been able to get to?
Yes. I have all kinds of kind of interests I've developed over the years that I've been unable to indulge in. Like, I got fascinated by the whole world of B-Westerns. And I've been compiling, you know, getting big stacks of B-Western DVDs. I haven't had a chance to start watching those yet. But what I've been watching now is stuff that there is no time for as a film critic, which is a limited series on TV. Because I never see, you know, every night I have goes to a film. So I watched Chernobyl, which I thought was excellent. And I'm in the middle of Our Boys, which is another HBO limited series, 10 episodes. Co-directed by Joseph Cedar, who's one of my favorite directors, Israeli director. So, I mean, you know, it's great stuff. I'm glad I finally have the time to watch it.
And especially those kind of limited series, do you find that you start putting your like film critic hat on? Because I find those limited series so fascinating for the way that they split the difference between being a movie and a more conventional television show. Because you can kind of digest them. Something like Chernobyl is a great example. You can digest it as like a single work.
Yeah, I think they are. They're just very long works. You know, we have a lot of filmmakers who make very long films. And I really feel these are kind of like, you know, Chernobyl's like a 5-hour film. Yeah, I mean, I think the way you put it is quite a good way. I mean, they are kind of halfway between, you know, conventional television and film, you know, because of their great length. But I think obviously so much of the style, the filmmaking is the same. Thing is, I mean, the great thing about them, as everyone has said, I mean, the films that we as movie critics and moviegoers have missed, the films that we so rarely get, the films that are focused on an adult audience, this is, they're all living here. You know, the reason they're not in our house is that they're in this house, you know. So it's great to see that they exist.
And now we're having this conversation on what I believe is your last day as a Times staffer. So in some ways, I kind of want this conversation to almost feel like a bit like your exit interview. And so, first of all, you announced a little over a week ago that you were stepping down. Is retirement the right phrase? Like, how are you referring to this?
You know, this is the phrase stepping down or stepping back just popped into my mind. And I kind of liked it, you know, and I said, I'll go with that. You know, it wasn't like it's been in my mind for it. Literally, when I was sitting kind of noodling about how, you know, to phrase it on Twitter, it just popped into my mind. You know, I am going to, I hope, still be, you know, as they say in the trades, I am in negotiations with the Times about, you know, doing occasional pieces. And I'm going to, you know, I'm never going to, God willing, I won't be stopping writing or stopping thinking about film. You know, retirement, it's not like I'm, you know, I mean, one of the great things that I remember, I had the chance to, you know, to interview Clint Eastwood on stage at Cannes a few years ago. And I asked him about retirement and he kind of gave me this look. And he said, you know, I play golf. I like to play golf. I don't want to have to play golf. And, you know, I kind of, retirement seems kind of like an odd word for me. It's hard for me to think of doing nothing as long as I can do things I want to be doing them.
Since you made the announcement about a week ago, there was just this tremendous outpouring of affection, I think both privately and in public. What has the last week been like for you? What has that meant to you?
It's kind of overwhelming. It's just, you know, I've been doing this a long time and it's a job, you know, it's a great job. It's work, you know, it's difficult, it's demanding, it's satisfying and challenging, but I just think of myself as trying to get my work done. I don't think of myself in the terms that people have been using for me. You know, I just think I'm just trying to meet my deadlines and think of something to say. And so it's been kind of, I don't know, you know, it's been enormously flattering and just very overwhelming. I mean, I still feel like I don't quite, I've gotten a handle on it. It's not what I expected. I knew there'd be a reaction. It's a big job. People care. But the extent of the reaction really took me by surprise.
Going back, you began your career as a sports writer. You came to the Times as a books editor before you then became film critic. What was your relationship like to film criticism when you came into the job?
Well, I had done, you know, I had been working as a freelance film critic in a variety of publications for many years. I had been a critic for, I think when I was still at the Washington Post in the early 70s, I started writing, someone I knew at the paper, they needed a political magazine, which still is being published, called The Progressive, founded by Fighting Bob LaFollette in Madison, Wisconsin, I think in 1909, a very long-lived political magazine, was looking for a film critic. And a friend of mine knew that they were looking for them and knew of my interest. So he connected me with the magazine and they hired me, and I did a monthly film review for The Progressive for a number of years. You know, I'd done film reviewing for, I was a regular reviewer for New West Magazine for a few years, and California Magazine, then GQ Magazine. So I'd done a lot of magazine film reviewing, but nothing like this job.
And the staff when you came on was a deep bench of heavy hitters. Charles Champlin was there, Sheila Benson, Michael Wilmington, Peter Rayner, and Kevin Thomas. What was it like just joining that particular roster of writers?
Well, by the time I became a critic, it was after Chuck and after Sheila. They were no longer there. And it was me and Pete and Michael. And I think Jack Matthews did some reviewing as well. It was great to have good critics with you. I mean, I think it's a very satisfying feeling. There's so much to do. You know, you can't cover everything. And, you know, for the paper's sake, I was delighted that there were such good people there to share the load.
And that period, it was like just kind of past the sort of heroic period of film criticism of like Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris. And like, what was sort of like the state of film criticism then?
Well, again, you know, I'm not one to think in those terms. You know, to me, it's just, I am just concerned with writing views that people will find interesting. I don't think, well, what era of film criticism am I in? You know, is this the Mesozoic age or is this, you know, some other age? It's just, you know, it is what it is. You know, I've had this conversation with Melissa Dargis, the New York Times film critic, you know, when a lot of this stuff started to go bad, you know, and basically we agreed it has always been hard to get these jobs. These jobs have always been difficult. I mean, the golden age is kind of overhyped. There were great critics working in that age, that is for sure. But in terms of, did people really care that much about reviewing? Was there a lot more reviewing? I don't know that that's sure, that that's true.
But do you feel like the sort of cultural impact or like the importance of reviewing, has that changed at all over the years?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think the biggest change I felt was with the rise of limited series and the rise of, you know, streaming services that bring them to people's houses. I mean, one of the major changes to film that we've all seen is that, you know, Hollywood, the studio films, they went in a very particular direction. They went in the tentpole direction. They went in the superhero direction. They went in the sequel direction. The kind of thoughtful films for mature adults that attracted me, one of the things that attracted me to writing about film, those became, you know, thinner on the ground. They became less of them. And, you know, you'd more hear about stuff like that from your friends who watched a lot of limited series. But on the other hand, when a major movie comes out, when something happens that captures America, even if it's something like Black Panther, which is nominally a Marvel film, but is so exceptionally well made that everyone felt they had to see it. Everyone wanted to talk about it. So film is kind of still central to the culture, but not at every moment.
Well, one of the things I always find so exciting and feel like remains vital about film criticism as just sort of like a vehicle is that it's this platform for talking about so many other things. Like, when you're talking about movies, you get to talk about, you know, all the issues that documentary is about, social issues, artistic issues, industrial issues. It's such a great platform to talk about so many other things.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, it sounds like it's a limited thing. All you're writing about is film. Well, as you just said, the opposite is true. You're writing about the entire world. Once you realize that, the job becomes, you know, much more involving and much more satisfying.
But especially as you've been teaching, Do you find the relationship that your students have to criticism or to filmmaking, has it changed? I think especially sort of in the post-internet era, do you think it's changed at all?
It doesn't feel as different as you'd think. I mean, there's still, you know, you still have to watch films and think about them and come to conclusions, you know, and that doesn't change. I mean, now, especially, you know, currently the class I teach at USC because of the virus, I teach it on Zoom. And that's different. So, and I, you know, I can't send them to theaters. We watch things on Netflix. So there are things, there are peripheral things that have changed. But I think the central core of the endeavor, which is seeing films and writing about them, that has unchanged.
Because one thing is, I was working on this piece recently where I reached out to some filmmakers to talk about you. I had never quite put it in this way for myself before. You have been reviewing so, like, say, the number of Clint Eastwood movies you've reviewed over the years, or the number of Mike Leigh films or Nicole Hoff Center films. And so what has it meant to you, not a, like a personal relationship with the filmmakers, but the relationship with the work that you, you know, these filmmakers that you come back to, you're looking at their work, you're reviewing their work over this period of 30 years. What has that meant to you? What is it like to have that kind of extended relationship with the work?
Well, it's very satisfying, especially if the filmmaker is doing interesting work. I mean, I can think of directors who I won't name who, you know, make a lot of films, and I would not want to be have an extended relationship with their work. When you talk about someone like Mike Leigh, who's made an exceptional series of films for, you know, decades, the more of them you see, the more of them you think about, the more of them you write about, it becomes a very deep experience. You really learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about culture. You learn a lot about human psychology. And you see people change with age, and you see people, not for the worse, but people just kind of getting different ideas, or their tendencies are going in a different direction. It's quite fast. You know, I think it really is a huge advantage to have that. I mean, you really, without that depth of knowledge, which you just get from experience, you could do it yourself. You know what I mean? You could sit down on a weekend and watch all the films. But to have them come at you over the course of years is very satisfying.
And have you found that as those filmmakers have sort of changed and evolved over time, has it mirrored your own maturity and development? Like, do you feel like you've been on like the same path as some of these filmmakers?
Well, not the same path necessarily, but you definitely feel that you are on a path. What's the same is that we're all on a path. We're not on this. Everyone's on their own path. I mean, there's nothing more personal. You know this, Mark, because you do it yourself. I mean, when you're a film critic, you know that there's nothing more personal than writing a review. And when you age and you become over time, you know, you're not a different person, but you change to a certain extent. You know, the things you're interested in change slightly as you age. Things you have no tolerance for change slightly. And so we're all, you know, it's kind of a natural evolution. So there's some films that maybe I would have more tolerance for today than I would have had 30 years ago, and vice versa.
And then in the same way, how have you managed personal relationship with filmmakers over the year? Has it become more complicated, or has it become more clear cut, like how to deal with that?
I don't really have a personal relationship with a lot of filmmakers. There's a certain number of filmmakers you can almost count on one or two hands that I have some relationship with, because I've met them at film festivals, and the paper's policy is to have me interview people at film festivals. So I've met them and talked to them. And again, if you've done it over a number of years and they've made films over a number of years, you see them, you know, over a number of years. And so you have kind of a relationship with them. But these are not, you know, these are not people I hang out with, you know. It's a strictly professional relationship, and it just kind of is what it is. You know, I'm always happy to see them if I like their work. If I don't like a particular film, I don't talk to them, you know. But, you know, it's just strictly, it's professional, you know. So I don't feel, I mean, that I could, you know, there are film critics we could name who really do like to have, you know, interact with filmmakers. And it's very tempting, because we all are all passionate about film, and it would be a lot of fun to hang out with filmmakers and, you know, kind of shoot the breeze about, you know, this or that film. But I've always felt that it's not good for me. And again, there are no rules for criticism. I think we all make up our own standard of conduct. But for me, it would feel wrong to hang out with filmmakers and then review their work. I know critics who've done it, and it doesn't seem to affect them. But again, for me personally, I know that this would not work.
And then a number of people also mentioned to me how much they enjoy being interviewed by you. And so now I'm being somewhat self-serving here. Do you have any tips? How do you prepare for interviews?
You know, the key to preparing for interviews is the realization that you can't research too much. You know, again, the other thing is I was, for many years before I was a full-time critic, I was a journalist and I made a living interviewing people. So I have going in much more experience with interviewing than most critics have. It's not something I developed while I was a critic. I walked into the job with a lot of years of interviewing experience. And I think, you know, there are two points. You know, number one is I research as much as possible. Now with Google, it's easy to find a lot of stuff that would have been harder to find in years past. I read as much as I can. I read other interviews. And also, I really find, and this is an obvious thing, but interest creates interest. A lot of the people we talk to as critics, they've been interviewed by a lot of people. It's not like we're the first people to ever ask them questions. And you can almost see sometimes when you walk in a room that you're number 700, and especially at a festival, you're number 762, you know, on an enormous press day. And to break through that kind of exhaustion and malaise, hopefully you have a genuine interest. Hopefully there's a reason you're there and you really can manifest that you're really interested in this person's work. And people really pick up on genuine interest. And I think that's very helpful. You know, they can see, okay, this person really is interested. You know, when people feel you're interested, they respond. You have to be genuinely interested. I try not to talk to anyone that I really don't want to talk to, because otherwise it's hard to have that kind of connection.
And do you have any favorite interviews from over the years, or like a particularly memorable encounters?
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, some of my favorite interviews happened before I was a film critic, when I did more movie star interviews. It's when I was working for the Washington Post, and I had a week out here in Los Angeles where I talked to, you know, they sent me out here. I came up with a list of people I wanted to talk to and set it up, and they said, fine. But I talked to Mae West, and she was at an age in her life where memories of childhood were very strong in her. And she told this elaborate story of going to buy ribbon with her mother and how beautiful the ribbon was. And it was quite a magical moment. And I interviewed John Wayne on his houseboat in Newport Beach. And when I think it was when, which film, maybe The Shootist came out. And, you know, he said, I can still remember vividly when it was over, he was showing me around and a lot of photos on the wall of him and, you know, Ward Bond and John Ford, like deep sea fishing, you know, and photos of them on boats, you know, battling with enormous fish. And he's just looking at these and shaking his head. And he just says to me, you know, most of my friends are dead. You know, it was such a poignant moment, you know, so. No, I've been very privileged to interview interesting people. There's nothing better than that.
And now along those same lines, do you have any favorite reviews? Having written so many reviews now, are there any that really stand out to you that you're proud of as a piece of writing or even just the way you've shown a spotlight on a certain movie?
I mean, I have done so many, it's hard to remember. There are a few that I think probably the more recent. I mean, obviously my Titanic review sticks in my mind because it caused a big fuss. You know, I had a review. One of the films I had to grapple with was Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. That was a very interesting review to write about, a very interesting film to write about. I really liked writing about Raoul Peck's I Am Not Your Negro. That really was a film that really meant a lot to me. And I felt I did a good job with, you know, and I remember for some reason, but just because it tickled me, I remember the opening paragraph more or less of the review I did for Twilight, the first of the Twilight films, where I wrote, I am not now, nor have I ever been a 16-year-old girl, but I wish I could have been to really appreciate this film to the fullest. So that sticks in my mind. God knows why.
I don't want to dwell on it, but I have to ask you about your Titanic review. I mean, it really, to me, it's one of the major sort of like affair de scandale of contemporary film criticism. You panned Titanic. James Cameron apocryphally sent it in via fax, a very angry letter to the Times. Were you surprised by that? Do you remember how you responded at the time?
Yeah, I was kind of flabbergasted. I mean, again, it's not unheard of for directors and other producers, other filmmakers to be unhappy with a given review. It's kind of part of the landscape. It's part of what happens. But usually you hear third hand or someone tells someone who tells you. But to respond so publicly, it was, you know, I'd never experienced that before. And I was just kind of surprised. And also the film was enormously successful even at that moment. So I was not, you know, it wasn't like I'd hurt the film in any way, shape or form. So I was just kind of, you know, it was perplexing. It's still a little perplexing.
And this is going to sound a little funny maybe, but to me, it raises a question for you. What is the purpose of a review? Like, what do you think they're sort of there for? Because it was interesting when I talked to Bill Morrison, the director of Dawson City Frozen Time, he said it meant so much to him to have someone get his movie as sort of like deeply as you did. And do you feel like that in part is the just the purpose of writing film reviews?
I'm happy when that happens. It's very satisfying to feel that you've understood a film and that you've helped a film. It's extremely gratifying. But in all honesty, that is not why I do what I do. You know, I interviewed, you know, I did this, as you know, I did an oral history of Joe Papp in the New York Shakespeare Festival. And part of the interviewing, I talked to several New York theater critics who had locked horns with Joe. And because I was a critic, even though I didn't have the LA Times job at the time, I was a critic. I was kind of chatting with them about criticism. And I think it was Clive Barnes, who was at one time both a theater critic and a dance critic for the New York Times, who said something to me that I've never forgotten. He said, criticism is a dialogue between the critic and the reader to which the artist can eavesdrop if they so choose. And I write in that spirit. I don't know nearly enough about film to be advising filmmakers. It's not my job to be telling filmmakers what they should be doing or could be doing. It really isn't. It's as a viewer talking to other viewers and saying, you know, this really bothered me, or wasn't this great? When I wrote what I did about Dawson City, my real goal was to convince people to see it, because I did have an exceptional, you know, I saw it at its first public screening and it just blew me away. And I don't know what anyone else would think, but I said, you know, this film has my name on it. I get this film. But my goal, once I feel that, is to convince other people you're going to like it too. That's what I want to be doing. I'm delighted that when filmmakers feel, you know, as positively as Bill did. Nothing could make me happier, but it's not why I write. I write to influence readers, to help them see something that they will enjoy. Not that I think is good for them, not that I think will advance cinema culture, but that they will actually enjoy.
And I want to be sure to ask you about film festivals and sort of the culture of film festivals and how it's developed over the years as you've been a critic. You're sort of a rare case where you are sort of, a lot of times people are like Cannes people or Toronto people or Sundance people, and you're like both a Cannes and a Sundance person, which seems like a rare sort of thing to me. And what do those festivals mean to you, and how have they maybe, you know, changed for the better or not over time?
It's interesting. You know, when I first went to Cannes, my first year at Cannes was well before I started working at the LA Times. I was working for the Washington Post, and I just ended up taking a trip to Europe, and I managed to get a Cannes press credential. It was 1971. And what I remember thinking so vividly in 1971, my God, this is an enormous festival. So many people here. And the festival in 1971, by today's standards, was tiny. You know, it always seemed big, but it's like gotten bigger, bigger, bigger. I think this is the case with all festivals. They've gotten bigger. And I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing. They've just gotten bigger. They're harder to navigate. It's harder. The logistical problems that are kind of tedious to talk about, but when you're trying to cover them, you know, things like, am I going to get into this screening that my editor really wants me to see the film? How early do I have to get there? Because every other critic there has an editor saying, you have to see this film. It becomes kind of like the logistics of these things you think about when you're there as much, at least I do, as much as I think about the films, you know, because you have to get in to see them or, you know, you're out of luck.
But as the festivals have grown, say Sundance, for example, do you feel like it still serves the films and filmmakers in the same way?
I think it does. I mean, Sundance has worked very hard not to get overrun by its success. Because so many people come there, and because it be, you know, independent film became a thing, and because, you know, tastemakers showed up, you know, there's a lot of commercialism there, that some of which the festival gets no money from and they can't control. But they've tried very hard, you know, both with their messaging and with the kind of films they pick, to make sure that they have not completely abandoned the ethos. I mean, I sometimes think, especially with the competition at Sundance, I sometimes think they intentionally pick the most non-commercial films they can find. You know, that if a film came out of the competition and, you know, made $20 million, they think they would have failed. You know, there are parts of the festival that welcome more commercial films, but they try very hard to keep the competition, you know, pure and untainted by anything but what the programmers think of as film art. And I could argue that case both ways, but I think for sure that Sundance is aware of it and Sundance is trying to deal with it.
And I know you're also a fan of sort of smaller, more specialized festivals. I think there's a silent film festival in Pordenone that you like. I've heard you speak of the Vespacho Festival in Burkina Faso. Like, what is it that's special about those more kind of specialized festivals in these maybe more far-flung locations?
Well, they're windows into the different worlds. The festival at Pordenone, the silent film festival, which now actually has a rival in Bologna. I mean, Italy is really kind of rife with festivals that, you know, are looking at older films, classic films. You know, first of all, I love those films, but also you get people who are passionate about these movies, and you get, especially in Pordenone, you get archivists from all over the world who have, you know, been poring over films in their archive and who've just gotten them in the best possible shape. And this is a place they show them to the world. It's been enormously successful. Russian silent films premiered there, Indian silent films. You know, there's a lot of stuff where you just see things you can't see anywhere else. And Vespacho in Burkina Faso, in Ouagadougou, Africa is a continent that really is passionate about cinema, and you get to see it, and you get to see people responding to it, and you get to see what film means in different cultures. As you know, I went to enough festivals that I finally wrote a book about them called From Sundance to Sarajevo, and it was just fascinating to see how each culture felt that they needed film, that film meant something to them, that they wanted to see themselves represented on the screen. The drive to see yourself on screen is a very powerful one, and it's a great drive. And I think the more people can do that, the better off we all are. Not only do people satisfied to see themselves, we as a world film culture, we're enriched. We get to see different kinds of stories. There's stories that we would never hear about if all we saw was films set in the United States.
Well, Kenny, I have to say, one of the things that I personally have found so inspiring in you is the way that no film is too small, no film is too obscure. You still sort of throw the full weight of yourself, your writing, your mind behind any movie that you're trying to get behind. And is that something that's like a really conscious decision on your part, or are you just kind of following your interests?
This whole job on some level is about finding things that you like, finding things that you want to support, finding things that you want to tell the world about. Especially at festivals, you feel tired, you feel jaded, you know, you get up, you stay up late, you get up ungodly hours of the morning to get the screenings on time, and you can feel really worn down. But I find inevitably, if I see something that excites me, it just, the energy jolt kind of wakes you up in a second. You know, we live for films that excite us. And when you find them, you want to share the joy, you want to share the excitement, you want to tell people, this is great, you're going to love this. You know, that's what drives me, not this will be good for you and you'll be a better human being if you see it. You're going to sit there and when it's over, you're going to say, this has been so great. That's what I want to convey.
And it doesn't matter to you where that movie comes from or the kind of what's behind it or anything like that?
No, it really doesn't matter to me. You know, I mean, there's satisfactions on all sides. It's very satisfying to have something like Black Panther, to have some enormous movie from the biggest movie factory going today, you know, the Marvel arm of Disney, to have a film from that enormous, you know, clanking machine, as my friend Richard Chickle used to say. It's very exciting to have that. It's as exciting to have films that come from little tiny places that you hadn't anticipated. First-time directors who are just getting started. They're both equally exciting to me for completely opposite reasons. You know, I just love film. And when I see one that I like, I'm just delighted. I don't care about anything else. It's like falling in love. If you fell in love with someone, you wouldn't care, well, you know, what zip code are they in? You say, you're delighted to have fallen in love. And that's the way I feel about movies.
Well, especially right now at this moment when, you know, the act of being able to go to movie theaters just feels like this unimaginable luxury. I can't help but wonder how you feel about, you know, in a big picture way, Hollywood and the future of movies. Is that something you spend a lot of time thinking about? Or like, especially right now, as everything's kind of on pause, I don't know how you feel about where we're going next.
You know, we're at one of these turning point moments. It's just not clear where we're going. We are facing a great unknown. We just don't know how this is going to play out. We don't know how long theaters will be closed for. I don't really worry that people will not want to come back, but I mean, I worry that places will go out of business. you know, that chains will go out of business, that small local theaters will go out of business. You know, I've already read stories in, you know, in the LA Times about places that are having difficulty, you know, places that are selling popcorn to their customers just to help raise some money, you know, that people who like the theater come by and buy tubs of popcorn and take them home. You know, we don't know how long this will last. It's one thing if it lasts 2 months. It's one thing if it lasts 12 months, you know, and the consequences will be different. So I just don't know. It's scary. It's worrisome. I mean, it's really possible that this will accelerate trends that people talk about. You know, smaller films being largely seen on streaming services. You know, it may be that small little theaters that show independent films will go out of business, never come back. I think, you know, as long as the world exists, there will be, you know, in the current iteration, people will want to go to the movies. Big event movies will draw people to theaters. I don't see that changing. But will, what will happen to the smaller films? Maybe, you know, what will happen? You know, this gets into very kind of inside movie business stuff. But, you know, the window, you know, which is the length of time between a film appearing in theaters and, you know, opening in theaters and when it can stream and be available on home video. The theater owners have held very strong that they need a certain amount of time with a film before it goes into homes, because otherwise, if it's like 2 weeks, people are going to say, well, I'll just wait the 2 weeks. I'm not going to go to the theater. So now, because people can't go to theaters, some studios are taking advantage of this and they're showing films much earlier to viewers at home than they otherwise would, which is what they've always wanted to do. So once this is over, what's going to happen? They're going to go back to the old status quo? Is this going to be the new status quo? Are theaters going to be decimated because the window is shrunk? Nobody knows.
But how do you feel about the direction that sort of Hollywood's been heading in as far as, you know, the dominance of franchise filmmaking and blockbusters, the fact that so often, like, I find I watch movies from the 70s and 80s, and their equivalent now would be like an art house film that'd be lucky to get distribution from like an A24, and you realize it was, you know, made and released by a studio. How do you feel about that? Like, do you think it's a problem, or is it sort of one of those cyclical things that's happened before?
It's hard to know. I mean, it's more extreme than what's happened before. I mean, I think the dominance of these kind of comic book movies, sequels, tentpole movies, I don't think it's ever been the way it is. I mean, I think even in the golden age of Hollywood, obviously the studios cared about audiences, but the kind of films, they felt that the audience was broader than they feel it is now. And a lot of kind of very adult themed films that we would think, well, no studio would do that now. Studios didn't hesitate to put them out in the golden age because they knew they had a very big audience and that people would like it. You know, it's worrisome that the adult sensibility has migrated to limited series. I mean, that's worrisome. It's everything though is understandable. I mean, you know, the studios, they're owned by big corporations. Their film budgets are enormous. This is a business. They feel they have to make money. So they make the things that they are surest will return their investment. And what happened with limited series and places like HBO is that they saw an opening. They saw this entire adult audience that liked more serious films. They saw it abandoned, sitting at home feeling bereft, you know, like someone who was stood up for a date, you know, expected someone to knock on the door and it didn't happen, you know. So they're sitting at home, they're got nothing to do. And look, here on TV is something for adults. Let's watch. I mean, it's as simple as that. So I think if you love theatrical film, I mean, I'm happy for the great stuff that's come out of, you know, that's on TV, besides now, you know, especially now I'm starting to watch it. But, you know, it is what it is. It's not coming back. The 1930s are not coming back.
And just the last thing I want to ask you, Kenny, is do movies mean the same to you now that they did when you started in this job? Like, do you still get joy from movies in the way that you used to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they mean absolutely the same to me. When I see a movie I'm excited about, I feel as excited as when I was, you know, 12 years old and saw I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang on TV in my house. When they're good, they absolutely have the same effect. What changes is that you have less tolerance for the bad ones. I don't shrug the bad ones off as easily as I used to. So my patience for what I don't like is less, but my joy in what I enjoy is undiminished.
Well, Kenneth Turan, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me today. Thank you for your service of almost 30 years.
I know. Well, thank you, Mark. I really, this has been great. You know, I'm still passionate about films. I still love watching films. It was just time for me to stop the daily reviewing. It's more of a logistic change than a change in passion or change in interest.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk again soon.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, as I said, hopefully I will still be contributing occasionally to the paper.
And I just want to say thank you again to Kenneth Turan for this interview and all the times he was a guest here on The Real. We hope to still have him on from time to time. And I think I can speak for all my colleagues here on the film team when I say that Kenny has always been the North Star, guiding the way with his generosity, curiosity, and professionalism. He'll be missed. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimsen, and our audio engineer, Mike Heflin. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.